Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money, KPCW's program about business, personal finance, real estate, investing, anything to do with making money, holding on to it, and making it grow. This is Pam Wiley with my co-host, Larry Warren.
And good morning. Today, our first guest is Wayne Rogers, and you'll know him not only from his days as Trapper John on the TV series MASH, but also as part of the panel on Fox Cable Channel's business channel, Cash and In Show. Wayne's an investor, entrepreneur, and lives part-time in Deer Valley. And he has a new book out, Make Your Own Rules, A Renegade Guide to Unconventional Success. So we will have Wayne Rogers with us in just a few moments. And Henry Mancini's take on the MASH theme. Wayne Rogers, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, you'll be happy to know that there's fresh snow today, and the temperatures have dropped enough that all the snow guns at all the resorts here are underway. So looks like we'll be able to start the ski season without too much trouble a little later on this month. How long have you had a Park City connection?
Oh, gosh, about 30 years, I would guess.
That's a start.
Okay. Yeah,
that's a big start.
That qualifies you as a Park City old-timer. So.
Yes, I think so.
Very fine. Okay, well, I would imagine the question most people would have if they haven't followed your careers is, what does an actor know about business and finance, and what business does he have writing a book about it?
I guess the answer to that is, what does anybody have any right to know anything about anything?
Right.
I mean, we had an actor who was the president of the United States, Ronald Reagan. We've had a president who was assassinated by an actor, Abraham Lincoln. So actors have done a lot of things. I don't think it has really anything to do with what your chosen profession may or may not be. You can have a reasonable amount of expertise in a lot of things. I tend to have been cursed with an inquisitive mind, and as a result, I'm very interested in a lot of things and constantly read about them.
And your book, now others will read about you, your book, Make Your Own Rules, A Renegade Guide to Unconventional Success, is really about as much about creativity, about diving in and finding your own way, not following all the rules.
Well, yes, and I don't mean that in a rebellious way. I mean that I think creativity... And I juxtapose that against administrative skills, that the creative side demands that you are constantly asking questions. You're asking not only why, but why not. You're challenging a traditional way of doing things, because you're not willing to accept the phrase, that's the way we've always done it. So, and that allows you to find new answers to old problems and answers to new problems. I just think that but you got to do your homework. I mean, this doesn't just come by asking questions. You've got to go out there and study whatever it is that you're trying to do. And in this case, the book is mostly about business. That if you're going to find the answers to some particular business problem, you had better immerse yourself, as it were, in all of the factual information you can get your hands on before you do this. The creative process, I use this as an example, Henri Poincaré, the famous French mathematician, was once working on a set of fusion functions and couldn't get the answer, but he had worked for years to try to find the answer, and he took a trip to the south of France and was coming back from the beach one day, stepped on the bus, and bingo, the answer hit him. But it didn't just happen then. It meant that he'd been working all that time. Neil Simon, whose plays I've produced a couple of times, everybody remarked to me, says, "Ah, oh, he's amazing. He's a genius. He wrote Brighton Beach Memoirs in 3 days." I said, "No, he didn't." They said, "Yes, he did." I said, "Yes, he inscribed it on paper in 3 days. He had been writing it for 30 years. It was in his brain somewhere." So the creative process is a process by which you do a lot of homework, which is stored in your subconscious mind, and the answer percolates up to the conscious at some point in, as you're doing this work.
It sounds like Edison, who said that genius was 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration.
I think it is. I think it doesn't just happen, as I say, Deus ex machina, out of the sky. You know, you have to have done all of the dirty work. I use this, an orchid, as beautiful a plant as it is, has its roots well grounded in manure. So you've got to do all of that kind of work before you produce the creative answer.
So was MASH part of that manure? I had to ask the question.
No, but no.
That's an odd way to put it.
Well, no. It's a good point, though, actually. I mean, I know you say that as a joke, but it's a good point that acting in its, you don't get there just by osmosis. The definition of acting is to live truthfully under the imaginary circumstances, and there are methods by which you get to that. Thus, the term method acting. There is a method by which one can find how to live truthfully in the imaginary circumstances, and that's the creative work you do. You may have to do it wrong 5 or 6 times before you find the right way. And that's what they call the rehearsal process.
And then real life is the next step, is acting honestly in real circumstances.
Well, real life is different. Those are real circumstances.
Exactly.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Those are not imaginary. Those are real circumstances. And mm-hmm. you respond to real circumstances, and acting is the ability to do that on the stage.
One thing I read about your interest and success in business comes from early on in New York. Your roommate was your friend Peter Falk, and Peter Falk made some money but lost it through bad investments or bad investments by his business manager, and you thought to yourself, I don't want to be like that.
Well, that's true. Really, what happened was, after Peter did that, he came to me and asked me. He said, "You got to help me here. I've lost this money, and you're my friend. Da 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 da. I don't know who to trust." That was kind of the initiation that I had to explore business. I was not wildly interested in business per se until that occurred. That got me interested in it because it was and we recovered most of Peter's money, as a matter of fact.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, Peter's the one who was suffering, not me. So it was, but that got me interested in the process, yes.
And I didn't mention in the intro that in addition to being on Fox Business Channel, you are chairman of Wayne M. Rogers & Company, which is investment strategy firm, and you have a chain of Stop and Save grocery and gas stores, and chairman of the board of Kleinfeld, which I don't know about because I've never shopped for wedding dresses in New York City. But,
shame on you, Larry. You should go get one.
Well, maybe with a daughter, perhaps.
And
a Broadway producer of great plays, including some Neil Simons like Brighton Beach Memoirs. So yes, you have the credentials on both sides. So let's talk a little bit about the economy and what's happening. How did we get into the mess we're in 30 words or less?
Well, I get that's very simple. It's just like everybody gets in the mess. We spend more than we earn. The United States government has borrowed from the future substantially because the politicians, it's easier to make promises than it is to deliver results. And we just have spent more than we should have. And the Congress, in their infinite stupidity, does not understand the system and continues to complicate it and make more and more mistakes. So I don't see any real, without having some sort of abrupt and drastic, a reform, I don't see this changing.
Mm. Well, when I saw you, I guess the weekend before last on Cashin' In, people were talking about the deficit reduction, and you were the one who said, let's go for $4.7 trillion and use the Simpson-Bowles plan. And everybody else just kind of acted like you hadn't said anything, and they just went on talking.
Well,
and I'm going,
wait
a minute.
Well, I think it requires that people have to be familiar with what Simpson and Bowles outlined in that plan, and most people are not, including the Congress again. Have they read it? Probably not. Listen, the Congress doesn't read the bills that they pass. We have elected 535 people to the Congress of the United States to represent us. They are supposed to be people who have our interests in their first order of business. They do not. They have their own selfish interests first. They're interested in getting reelected. They're interested in getting bribed by lobbyists. That is their interest. The Dodd-Frank so-called reform, financial reform bill is 2,200 pages long. These are morons, these people. They did not read it. They passed it. Do they know what's in it? Not at all. I confess, I only read 200 pages of it, and that's enough. The Glass-Steagall bill, which was passed after the crash in 1929 and was passed to reform and, by the way, worked wonderfully for 60 years. It was the origin of the SEC, the origin of the FDIC, et cetera. And it separated, the key point was it separated commercial banks, being defined as those that take deposits and make loans, from investment banks, being defined as those who underwrite securities, trade stocks and bonds, derivatives, etc. And it separated those two. That was canceled in 1999 and allowed to get. That was the beginning of the downfall again. Now, does the Dodd-Frank bill cure that? No.
Okay, so
it does not.
So let me just rephrase it so that I understand it. So with the Glass-Steagall Act, it said, okay, you banks, you have to do conservative investments, period. You can't do speculative investments.
No, it didn't say you have to do investments at all. It said you who are investment banks cannot be in the business of taking deposits and making loans. You who are commercial banks cannot be in the business of trading securities.
Okay. And
it separated those two functions.
So what happened is that the same kind of thing that happened in 1929 happened in 2008, where banks were over-leveraged?
Absolutely. It's going to happen again, too,
because
the Dodd-Frank bill does not address that. The Glass-Steagall bill was 28 pages long. This bill is 2,200 pages, and the people we elected voted for it. They don't know anything about it.
Okay, now, talking about accountability, I would have to say, what about the voters? Because we voters are... We say, okay, tell us what we want, and we'll vote for you, instead of looking at people's track record. Now, you wouldn't tell people to invest that way. Pardon?
It is our own fault.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nature.
We are the recipients of our own stupidity.
Well,
we have elected people to the Congress who don't read. We have allowed that to happen. Yes, it's our own fault, and we will rue that day.
And the rule of thumb in politics is everybody hates Congress but loves their congressman. So you repeat that over 435 districts, and you get the exact same Congress pretty much every 2 years.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but you're essentially right in the sense that the gerrymandering of districts and all that pretty much guarantees that a district will be either Democratic or Republican, and as a consequence, will whoever the party nominates, yes. And the other problem, of course, is we don't have term limits, then everybody's constantly running for re-election. And the major impetus to this is the lobbying. As long as you have lobbyists and people who are willing to spend a fortune to buy a vote, listen, Alexis de Tocqueville, writing in 1831 when he was, critiquing the American system, wrote very cogently the following. He said, the republic will cease to exist when the Congress discovers that it can bribe the people with their own money. And he was absolutely right. That's essentially what has happened.
Did you happen to see Jack Abramoff on 60 Minutes last night?
No, I missed that. I would love to have seen it.
Well, it turns out he's now an accountant for a bagel shop. But he was once the top lobbyist in America, and he basically just flat out said all lobbying is bribery. That's the
well,
only...
he should know.
And he was the king of it.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's still the system. He just got caught.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Did you know there are 11,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C.? 11,000. That's larger than some small towns. Not only that, that does not take in the unregistered lobbyists, people who are quote-unquote advisors who fly under the flag. It's an outrageous system.
Okay, what's the solution, or what are the solutions?
Well, I think they are possibly twofold. One, if we continue to spend and not pay our bills, we will obviously ultimately at some point in time end up like Greece and be bankrupt. And the result of that would be, I assume, I'm basing this on the historical path of mostly South American, quote, South American republics, where once that occurs and the economy goes to hell in a handbasket, people get in the street, you have riots, they call out the military, and we end up with some sort of a military dictatorship. And I could envision that as a possibility, a bad possibility, but a possibility. The other way is that at some point we will elect a courageous president and Congress who will go along with that president to correct this. It is that would be enormously difficult for the people to swallow. People tend to be selfish themselves. They are not going to be interested in giving up things. Let me give you an example, a specific, for example. At the turn of the last century, I'm talking about 1900 to 2000, the average life expectancy was 47 years old. Today, that's 77 years old. That's 30 years. It's a remarkable thing that we've done with medical science and nutrition, et cetera. However, when the retirement, I'm talking about now Social Security Act, was passed, it was in the 30s. Our life expectancy has increased over 10 years since that time. Did we in any way change Social Security? No. It was based on numbers and retirement ages that were existent at the time it was passed. Well, you can't continue that and have people who are on the dole, as it were, for that long afterward and have asking the rest of the population to support us. I'm an older person, but I have to give that up.
And
it's
asking
not
our,
right.
Asking our children to pay for it. That's the
that
worst
is correct.
Thing. We're saying we're saddling you with debt for the rest of your lives.
Well, that was the way it was ill-conceived. That is to say, it was not based on people who are earning now to pay in the system to pay for us who are older and no longer there. It wasn't done that it wasn't. In other words, Social Security was not robbed. It was ill-conceived in that sense. We didn't actually take out money out of our paycheck that went into a savings account.
Right.
That didn't happen.
Right.
And as a consequence, there's no money there. You know, it's going to run out as the population changes and as our earnings go down. Well, you can't have that. That's got to be changed. Are people willing to do that? Would you have old people riding in the streets when you take away some? You may. I don't know how to cure that. I'm perfectly voluntarily saying I would give it up because I believe in you know, the Constitution of the United States, and I think we've got to survive. But there are a lot of people out there who don't care.
Yeah. Well, we had Alan Simpson on our program, and he certainly told us about the what he and Erskine had done, Erskine Bowles had done, and it sounded great. But let me just posit something with you, and that is that right now we have lobbyists from several sides saying, "Oh, you watch out for the other side; they're bad guys." And we have a sense that we're on two separate teams, but aren't we all on the same team? This is what I don't understand. We are all on the same team, and it's we either hang together or we hang separately.
Well, you're describing the political situation, not
right.
The economic one. You're describing that people are saying, oh, the other side wants this and refuses to recognize that we want that, and therefore they are the obstructionists. Well, both sides are being obstructionists in that sense. They both have got to give up something, yes. I think the Republicans are going to have to give up this idea of no raise in taxes. They've got to have some raise in the tax system. It's got to be revived in some form or fashion. The Democrats, on the other hand, have got to give up that certain sacred cow programs can't be cut. They have to be cut. You can't continue to do this. Now, if they are both going to be, say, well, you can't cut mine and I can't cut yours, yes, you're going to have just what you said. In situations like this, reality will ultimately dawn on those people, and they will have to do something. Now, you would hope, I don't see any evidence of it, but you would hope that reasonably intelligent people could come together. I think Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson took a very reasonable, down-the-middle approach to this thing. The Congress just won't buy off on it. Why? Because they're bribed. They're all bribed.
Okay, now...
And I say that in the best sense of the word. They're bribed by the lobbyists.
There is no best sense of that word.
Now...
Well, okay.
You've written a wonderful book about entrepreneurialism. And
yes.
So when we see the rest of the world going to you-know-where in a handbasket, okay... we can still be entrepreneurs. So what's the best advice there for what we can do?
I think that anybody can, you mentioned, you're going to have somebody on later on your show, I think, that owns the Grubstake, is
mm-hmm.
that correct?
Yes.
Yep.
Well, there's an example of a small business that has existed for a number of years in Park City, and those kinds of businesses, that is, small business creates about 80% of the jobs in the United States. If we can get rid of a lot of the over-regulation of those businesses by government entities, you can survive. That is to say, small business will always survive. Trade among Homo sapiens is, you know, some 30 or 40,000 years old, so I don't see that declining, and that means that at some form of free market capitalism will always exist. Is it going to exist in the best sense of the words that we have developed in the last 100 years? No, I don't think so. I think my generation is probably, maybe my children's, but not my grandchildren's, is probably the last to, they have to get used to a different standard of living. We have borrowed too much from our grandchildren and our children to make our own standard of living too high, as it were. So it's got to have some settling down now. But the future of that is still in small business, and that's where people can always practice capitalism.
And are there more opportunities now, as interest rates are so low, as a lot of highly skilled people are out of jobs in bigger corporations for entrepreneurship?
Well, I don't think a lot of highly skilled people are out of jobs. I think I spoke recently there in Salt Lake to the greater Utah, you know, economic group there.
Right.
And I said, I'm walking around the room and talking to people. There are a lot of highly skilled jobs going wanting. We have not, if we have a gap, it's in our educational system. In other words, that guy who used to take a bucket of rivets and walk across the floor and rivet something, that job is gone. But that job is gone forever. In other words, he's systemically lost. That job is gone overseas. He's been replaced by a numerically controlled machine that is operated by somebody with a computer who punches out a tape. And that guy, who is highly educated and skilled, that guy is the secret to job creation. But we have got to educate those people. So those people, that manual labor job is, to a great extent, gone. That is the great majority of those. What we need to do is educate, and there's a gap in that, and our workforce has got to get educated to that. And I think those jobs I know a number of those where there are a lot of job openings for highly skilled people.
Well, also, I think you have given us inspiration just on starting with that curiosity. If you start with curiosity, you're going to be another Abraham Lincoln, and you're going to educate yourself and find out, okay, what is business all about? Is it dog eat dog? Is there a higher standard? What works?
I think so. In any, as I said, in almost any society, you're going to have a certain amount of that. Even we think about China being a communist society. No, it's not. It's a huge capitalistic system masquerading as communism. Mm-hmm. The Chinese leaders have managed somehow to maintain control of it without having an outburst of... But as that middle class grows in China, and it is growing, and it's growing very rapidly. For example, more Mercedes-Benz are sold in the country in China than any other nation in the world. They have more millionaires than we have. Why is this happening in China? It's because they can't stop it. In other words, capitalism, free market capitalism, is going to will out. Now, if you have revolutions and wars and that kind of thing, that can stop it, yes. But other than that, you can't stop it. So there's always going to be, when you say people who are curious, who want to earn, who want to make a better life for themselves, that is always going to prevail.
Okay, well, we can't let you go, and time is running out without asking some fun MASH questions. So let's move on to there. Are you still known and recognized for your MASH years, which were only three, after all, about 40 years ago? Is that still your and is that, and does that get a little tiring?
Larry, no, not. Let me reverse the answers. It doesn't get tiring in the following sense. It was very good to me. You go through life as an actor doing all kinds of things. You never know what is going to actually register with the public. MASH registered with the public. It made me a recognizable person in the business of acting, and for that I'm eternally grateful. It also sent my kids through school. For that I'm eternally grateful. Whether or not today, when people say, yes, there are reruns on it, reruns all the time, as we are speaking now, it's running somewhere in the world, which is remarkable to me. But I know, I think people see him. I've been on under contract to Fox in the Fox news channel for 8 years now, I believe. So people see that, and but it's a different group of people. You have a financial show, and I'm sure your audience knows your show very well. But there are other audiences that don't know your show because they don't listen to it. So the same thing happens. People who are interested in one thing, and we have, as you well know today, you know, an absolute plethora of television and radio stations that we can listen to. And they are defined down to the point where you can say, well, I only want to know about, you know, people between the ages of 20 and 25 who are interested in cooking. Well, you can find that show. The fact that the audience is divided and there are very few shows that, you know, that cover all of that. I'm fortunate to have had MASH behind me and Fox today.
And you left MASH after 3 years. McLean Stevenson also left early on. Was there, dissension on the set? It seems like it must have been a fun show to do. It just seemed not like acting, like a bunch of people goofing around with the cameras rolling. It was a little harder than that.
That is why they call it
acting.
If you can make it look like that, we worked very hard to make it look like we were not working. That's exactly the art of acting. The craft of acting is to make all of that look like just what you said, like you're goofing around. Well, those scripts were written. They were rehearsed over and over again. And when people say, well, when you rehearse a joke over and over again, it gets old. No, it doesn't. You get better at telling it. And I know people who tell stories, and every time they tell the story, they get better at telling it. So it's the same thing. You work very hard to make it look like you're not working.
Well, we appreciate you telling your story. It's a wonderful one, and we hope people pick up the book. And it is Make Your Own Rules, A Renegade Guide to Unconventional Success, which you've co-written with Josh Young. Wayne Rogers, you are just absolutely stellar. And you have, and not to mention, you have endorsements not only from Alan Alda, but from Neil Cavuto. Now, anybody who can get endorsements from both those people, that's pretty good.
There's the left and the
right.
Well,
you know, I signed some books there at Dolly's bookstore in Park City, you know, a couple of months ago. And they were very kind to me there. And I'm sure they still carry the book.
Well, we have their copy of it right now, and it's going to go back there to be sold. So, So anybody who wants the one that was used to interview Wayne Rogers, we have it right here, and it'll be back at Dolly's by this afternoon. So, so we thank Dolly's, and we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Wayne Rogers, thanks very much, and we'll see you here this winter skiing.
Thanks.
Yes, you will.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you.